welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Chittagong University in Bangladesh is one of several institutions of higher learning with which MTSU has a reciprocal relationship. And helping to further that relationship was Dr. Richard Hanner, who is a professor of economics and finance here at MTSU. We are helping Chittagong with their book supply and at the same time establishing good relations and spreading goodwill and perhaps extending the relationship into the future with faculty and student exchanges. And Dr. Hanner is here to talk with us more about that today. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Jenna. I'm pleased to finally get in the studio and see what it looks like and do a program.
Are you impressed?
I am. I've always been more interested in radio in terms of a medium because it allows me to sit back and absorb the conversation, and I hope that's what our audience can do today.
Well, we like to keep things on a nice conversational level on this program, so that's a good thing. You went to Chittagong, which is one of two institutions at which Dr. Muhammad Yunus, the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize winner, taught, the other one being MTSU, and you got to talk to students there and to faculty, and from all accounts, you received a very warm and gracious welcome. Tell us about that.
Well, it was an extraordinary experience, actually, and there's many, many parts of this story, but I'd like to answer your question directly first, and we can just go from there.
Okay.
I was in Bangladesh in December last year, 2010. For 2 weeks, and two parts of that trip. One was to visit Chittagong University. The other was to visit Grameen Bank and Muhammad Yunus and have develop a better understanding of microloans. The first part of the trip was at Chittagong, and just a bit of background for the audience is you're quite correct. Dr. Muhammad Yunus, who received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006, has only taught at two institutions. He taught here at MTSU in the early 70s and also taught at Chittagong University. The story is kind of interesting in terms of the linkage where I get most of my really good ideas is from students, and we were discussing Dr. Yunus's work one day in my class with the Buchanan Fellows in the Honors College. And the question came up, well, are we doing anything with Dr. Yunus? And to his credit, and I'd like to certainly recognize Dr. Kiyoshi Kawahito, a colleague of mine, has kept in touch with Dr. Yunus for decades. And as it turns out, coincidentally, he was emailing him the day I walked in and had some discussion with him about what the student said. And this led to Dr. Yunus suggesting that, well, maybe there was something that we could do to develop a relationship with Chittagong University, and hence my trip in December. Now, the reception there was extraordinarily warm for a number of reasons. One, I have to tell the story that I was one of the talks I was giving was at the College of Social Science, and it's a large auditorium, maybe 200-300 students in there. The only time in my life, or maybe that I expect to have this experience, about 100 students came up to me after and asked for my autograph. I mean, it was my moment as a rock star, I guess.
And didn't the entire student body turn out for you
on
one or two occasions?
They certainly did. Bangladesh as a whole, and Chittagong certainly represents this, places a very high premium on education. These were very highly motivated students. Their English skills were excellent. And so I had asked to go into classrooms as well, and I was invited to give several lectures. So to get a feel for their system and the facilities they had to work with, that was a great experience. I met with several administrative officials there as well. And the real bonus of that week that I spent in Chittagong was that I was primarily hosted by Dr. Irshad Khan, who is the chair of the economics department at Chittagong University. a truly wonderful, wonderful person to spend time with. We had very similar sense of humor and adventure, and he was very gracious with his time. And it made me feel very welcome, and I would certainly go back. As a matter of fact, I've invited him if he sees the opportunity in the future to come here to MTSU.
And one of his colleagues is already here, Alauddin Majumber, who is working on his second master's degree.
Yes, this was an outgrowth of a lot of work that Dr. Kawahito did. So this story has different parts that we were working on, and one was to try to bring a student over to enroll in our master's program in economics and hopefully going to work in our do work in our PhD program as well. Alauddin Majumder has turned out to be an excellent student, one of the top students in the program. He is probably going to finish the master's program by the end of the summer. And just to give the audience an idea of the sacrifice that he made to come here, he has a newborn baby that he had to leave. In Bangladesh, he will not see his family for a year. Fortunately, when I was there, he did make arrangements for me to go visit his family. And it's an extended family. His wife's parents live with him. And I got to meet the baby, took some pictures. And so it was very warm in all respects. And we certainly wish him the best, whether he stays here in our PhD program or goes on to other PhD programs. And so that was a nice piece to work in with this cooperative endeavor. We would hope to find some financial support to bring one person a year over for the next 2 to 3 years, because that would greatly strengthen our ties with the Chittagong and develop a longer-term relationship with that institution in the at that academic dimension.
Now, what about student exchange? Under the auspices of Dr. Kawahito, we've already had one extraordinary student, Steve Sibley, spend some time in Bangladesh, is interning at the Grameen Bank, which was founded by Dr. Yunus, but he didn't just stay in Dhaka. He got out and into the countryside and went to the social businesses and saw how people live and experienced poverty up close and personal, which was part of the deal.
Yes, it is. And you cannot escape the up close and personal aspect of poverty in Bangladesh. It is a very poor nation, but it is a very civil nation. And just to give the audience a mental picture of the population there and how it fits, Bangladesh is approximately 150 million people. Roughly 30 times the population of Tennessee, but the landmass of Bangladesh is only about 10% larger than Tennessee. So you have a very high-density population, a very poor nation, but some people might be surprised to know that essentially Bangladesh feeds itself. It gets very little foreign aid. So it's a very interesting country in this dimension. Just to come back to Steve Sibley for a moment, this I think was about 2 years ago that Steve went over and did the internship with Grameen Bank. And they're very very methodical about exposing interns to what the bank does and getting out into the countryside. We are, Dr. Kawahito and I are prepared to help send another student, but it takes a very extraordinary and resilient student who wants this kind of experience. So the screening process is, we make it pretty tough for that reason. I would say, just as a footnote, that Steve was quite interested in this internship, and he is now working on a PhD in finance at Purdue University, and I stay in touch with him, and he still is interested in a lot of the ideas that he picked up on when he was there.
But if you come from a middle-class background in a Western country, developed, industrialized country like the United States, and you think you know poverty, you don't know poverty until you've been to Bangladesh.
That's a good way to phrase it. You don't know poverty. That's probably a good title for a paper. That's quite true. You can go into the poorest areas of the United States, and you will see amenities there that the average person in Bangladesh could not even dream of. There's a certain unevenness to what people have access to. For example, I was quite surprised. I asked, for example, I would go into a classroom with 100 students and ask how many had a mobile phone. They all have one. So they have leapfrogged the technology. Owning a mobile phone there is very inexpensive, and it's very essential because there's no other communication infrastructure like we have. The poverty is not it's not the kind of poverty you see driven by war-torn, crisis upheaval kinds of countries that we hear about today. It's simply a matter of the resources available to this number of people. So you drive through the countryside, you will see people living in basically what we would see as a brick hut with a tin roof. And there are villages everywhere outside of the larger cities. I think the striking thing may be the poverty in the large urban cities like Chittagong or Dhaka. But again, it's after spending 2 weeks there, I would say it struck me as a very civil society. It is not a place where tourists go. By their own admission, Bangladesh has no tourist industry. I think I spent about 5 days on the road into and out of northern Bangladesh and may have seen two Westerners in what I would estimate a couple of 3 million people that I actually saw with my own eyes.
Steve said when he first got to downtown Dhaka, children started running after him. It was like they immediately gravitated to the Westerner, as you know, give me something, sell me something, let me sell you something like that.
That will vary depending on what part of the city you are in. It's a city of about 14 million people. Mm-hmm. Like all cities, even in the United States, there are parts of the city that you would not feel comfortable in, parts of the city you could walk around anywhere. Steve probably had a more direct experience in that respect than I did because, I was catered to a bit more, let me put it that way.
Right.
But I did make it a point to go to the facility. I stayed in the facilities where the Grameen Bank interns stay. It was maybe two or three blocks from the bank itself. I walked that whole area because when we send more interns, I wanted to be able to convey to them, okay, this is the facility. I took pictures and things like this. And so that they would know that it's not some image in their mind that is either off-putting or frightening or anything
right.
like that.
I didn't mean to imply that Steve was frightened. These were little children running after
him. Oh, yes.
And
yeah,
so it
yeah.
was just more of a stark indication of the extent of the poverty. As a matter of fact, Steve told me he felt very safe throughout his entire experience there.
I think Steve was speaking, you're quite correct, it wasn't words of fear. It was words that expressed how he felt in his heart.
Yeah.
And because we all want to help people. And this would be true, I think, in a lot of areas of Asia. If you go into large cities, especially the developing countries, the population density is such that you're, as Americans, we're very individualistic. We like our space. Well, you just don't. You don't have that.
You don't have the space.
That's right. And so it's nothing to be surprised about when you go into some of these areas that people just crowd around and look at you. It's not unusual at all for if you go in, especially rural area, and people wondering, well, here's somebody that looks totally different than anything I've seen before, and just crowd around and look at you.
Yeah.
They mean no harm. They're curious. They like to ask questions. I found the Bangladeshis extremely curious and very direct about their questions.
Dr. Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for helping to promote the concept of microcredit and microfinance as a means of helping to lift people up out of poverty, not only in his country, but around the world, and promotes the concept of a social business, which I call it capitalism with a conscience.
Yeah.
You as an economist might want to call it something else. I don't know if you're a Keynesian or not, but Talk a little bit about how microcredit and microfinance is supposed to work under the UNIS model.
Yes, let me go straight to the UNIS model, because he tells a very touching story in his first book about micro lending, where he was in his classroom at Chittagong University, and like all economists, he was drawing graphs on the boards and equations. And this was during a very difficult time in Bangladesh where there was a famine. And he would walk over and look out the window and see people wandering in from the countryside who were just starving to death. And he couldn't reconcile that with what he was teaching. I mean, how was he making a difference in the world? So he actually assigned some students to go out and talk to these people and understand what was going on in terms of their poverty and being displaced, and to ask them what it would take to help, and came to the conclusion that it's just a fact of human nature that we all have some skills, we all need some help when things go wrong. And he wanted to help them start businesses, and this whole idea started with $27 he took out of his own pocket. Now, I think it's important for the listeners to know that Grameen Bank itself, it operates in the rural areas of Bangladesh by charter from the government. It's not in the urban areas yet, specifically targeting to help women and build the infrastructure around women and families and work to help lift women and children out of poverty. It's been quite successful in that respect. This has become a worldwide movement, if you want to use that term, in several countries. Other institutions have gotten involved, and some have not been well received or have not been as altruistic, I think, as Grameen Bank. He more recently has gone on from that idea to the concept of social business, which is the last book he published last year. And the basic idea is, if you look at the whole capitalist infrastructure, I think it's accurate to say it's built on the principle of self-interest. And he sort of balances this in his mind with capitalism is theoretically a half-finished system in the sense that the other half is what are we doing for the selfless component that is a part of human nature, too. Economists would probably have as many disagreements about this as anybody, but I think he's been quite articulate in voicing his view in this respect.
Now, these low-interest loans, I understand Grameen has a very high payback rate. I mean, we're not talking about major defaults here.
No, they're extraordinarily high payback. I can't remember the exact number, somewhere between 95% and 99%. And the reason for that is that it's not just the way we think of a loan. Once you get the loan, you can do all kinds of things with the loan and maybe not pay it back, even as we've seen in recent years here. In that micro lending system, they try to build an infrastructure, a community support base around people who are taking the loans out to help them be successful in whatever small business they are going to undertake. Representatives from the bank live in rural areas, and they meet periodically with groups. And these would all, if you went to a meeting, it would be all women, mm-hmm. because that's the group that they're working with. And they will report on successes. Maybe someone has a problem, and they say, well, we need people to help them be successful in their economic endeavor here. And then that's where the money is collected to pay back the loans. Everything is it's like a walking into a room on a desk and opening up your briefcase, and that's the bank.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they're helping these women establish what might be called in this country kind of cottage industries, right? Caning chairs or basket, yes. Weaving, things like that?
Even more sophisticated than this. They start with whatever skills they have, and once they show success, then they move on to other things. Some may, for example, want to have what are called baby taxis. They're very small, liquefied natural gas-powered vehicle to deliver yogurt, let's say, or something that serves the public, and they can start a little business this way. Once they've paid off that loan, they may decide, well, we want to branch out and do maybe have several of these kinds of vehicles. Or cottage industries at home are very prevalent, as you mentioned. Bangladesh has a very a long history, and I think the way to describe it, a colorful history in textiles. Now, lots of clothing is made at home, and the women have those skills. They don't have the capital, so a small loan helps them to get whatever sewing machine or other device that gets them started. There is a part of lending that goes on at Grameen Bank that is actually for beggars. It's hard for us to conceive of doing that, but it's been successful in the sense that the beggars have a high payback on their loans. But the idea is, let's give them a skill. I mean, if they're going around asking people for money, maybe they can sell something as well. So it's starting to have a more positive impact on their economic life.
And one would imagine self-esteem and feeling good about being able to accomplish the task of selling something, feeling that that sense of well-being and having earned your money.
Yeah, I think there's something quite true in this. This seems to be a universal human trait to, if nothing else, appears though we're productively employed. And I say that even beyond the bounds of capitalist kinds of systems. Even command economies are built around the idea of, well, you have a job, maybe you're not producing anything, but you have a position and things like this. So there's something about our identity, and beyond that, our aspirations for the future, I think, that are connected to helping ourselves and then helping other people, whether these be immediate family members or other people as well.
And when it comes to a more sophisticated social business, Dannon, which is a major company, has established a yogurt factory in Bangladesh. Right?
Yes. The background story there is, I think Dr. Yunus was in Europe at a conference, and the president of Dannon, or Danone yogurt, I guess would be the way I would pronounce it if I was in France, asked him what could he do to help. And Dr. Yunus said he'd been pondering this idea of social business. And the way this played out is Dannon came to Bangladesh, had to completely re-engineer what a yogurt factory was around the idea of, well, if you're going to make yogurt, for example, you need milk. Where do you get the milk? Well, then the micro-lending came in part to help farmers in the area who maybe had a milk cow or bought a milk cow. And the milk is collected at a certain collection point, tested for quality, and the people are paid for the milk. And then it's transported to the factory. Yogurt is made, and then it's distributed back out to the people within that area. Now, this whole collection system, this whole production system, the whole distribution system, is built around the idea of a social business, which is saying this business doesn't just exist to make a profit for the owners. Think of all the people now that are being productively employed who would have been impoverished with no hope. The people with the milk cow, the person collecting the milk, the persons in the distribution system, both in the collection of the milk and the cooling of the milk and the selling of the yogurt. And the other objective there that's quite admirable is a lot of work went into developing the right kind of yogurt for Bangladeshis. They needed high nutrients content and other additives, because if it's being fed to babies who are very young, within that first year or two, the health improvement is dramatic. So that's who they were trying to reach. So all this was considered in what we would call a business plan.
And isn't it refreshing that they took the local needs and the local culture into consideration instead of just blowing in there like the stereotypical Westerner and saying, my way or the highway?
That's what happened there. And now, Dannon had to buy into the fact that they would make this investment in the idea of social businesses. They will never get more back than what they put into it. So the profits are not something that are accruing back to the company or to the shareholders. This is something that they felt was extraordinarily important to do as a social business, and I keep using that term.
The investors do not get back anything more than their original investment. They don't make dividends ad infinitum.
That's very correct. I will say this, though, after visiting the Dannon factory, I think the company learned a great deal that will transfer from what they did there into their for-profit part of the organization. They had to scale down what the normal size of a plant was by probably much less than half that would be the most productive size. They had to rethink distribution. They had to think about the kind of yogurt they made and how it tasted. One of the things I learned while I was there was Bangladeshis have a sweet tooth. So the yogurt had to be a little sweeter than normal. So all this process of learning how to incorporate the local culture into your planning of a business operation, I think in a way has greatly benefited them because they're a global corporation. When they go into other areas, a lot of these same kinds of things need to be investigated more thoroughly to be a profitable business.
And again, thanks to Dr. Kawahito, we now have a UNIS program here at MTSU under the College of Business to help students and faculty learn more about Dr. UNIS's teachings on microcredit, microfinance, and social businesses.
Yes. We can't give Dr. Kawahito enough credit because the sweat equity that he put into making these things happen are rather extraordinary. As a matter of fact, as we're sitting here talking, he is probably landing in Tokyo or in Tokyo already going to a global conference that deals with these kinds of topics. He's been very active in keeping up with what's going on globally, and I might say very supportive in many ways, including financially, of trying to get for example, our graduate student who's come over, Mr. Majumdar, and in other ways as well. I should mention that the other thing that we've done is, I think you mentioned this on the front end of the program, was our collection of textbooks to ship to Chittagong University. Many of our students may sell textbooks back at a greatly reduced price, and we gave them the opportunity to just donate the book, and we found a way to ship them to Chittagong University. And I'd like the audience to understand that textbooks there are so valuable and too expensive really for the students to buy them that when I was there, I visited where they had them kept, and there's a special cabinet with someone who keeps track of the books, labeled thanks to MTSU for these books, and we have another batch we're about to ship.
They're under lock and key, aren't they?
But they are. I mean, I don't want to imply to the audience that the students can't use them. It's just they're considered so valuable that they do keep them locked, and because they want English language textbooks because they want their students to be very well versed in English.
And we're talking about hundreds of pounds of
yes.
books. And the Honors Student Association helped also in collecting those books.
Yes. I would like to certainly recognize Daniel Gouger and the Honors Student Association and the Honors College for helping in this effort. We expect to do this as long as we can find some minimal support several times. As a matter of fact, I've gotten a university in Canada interested in doing the same thing, so maybe this will be a movement that will spread beyond MTSU's boundaries.
And this is all part of helping to internationalize the campus, which is an internationalized education, and the curriculum, which is a major priority from the administration on down throughout the bureaucracy.
It is, and that's exactly what I bring home with me when I take these kinds of trips. I incorporate what I've learned into my teaching, give students an idea of the broader world, and hopefully encourage them to go out into that world from whatever perspective or major they may have and learn and to think about a larger context.
You don't really know unless you've been there, right?
No, that's quite true. You can read a lot and prepare yourself. I tried to do the same thing when I was getting ready to go over. But there's nothing like going, and I think there's a certain amount of satisfaction in knowing you could do it on your own. You could get to the country. It's a very, very long flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I had help once I got there, but, you know, you still have to navigate through very unfamiliar terrain.
Dr. Richard Hanna, Professor of Economics and Finance at MTSU, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'd love to come back sometime.
You will. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.